Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
It's the Psychobabble Panel, the three lifelong dedicated psychological therapists who can laugh at themselves and call themselves the Psychobabble Panel. And Roz, you were saying you think it's quite important that we can laugh at ourselves.
I think it is probably the most important human ability. I really do. And I think especially at the moment, because it's something we seem to have lost. There are so many of those famous philosophers. I can't remember who. Confucius said it. Plato said it. I think Socrates said it. They didn't talk about laughing about themselves so much, but their general point was wisest are those who understand they don't know everything.
Yeah.
Who can look at their own shortfallings. And that's the point where I would inject laugh at their own shortcomings, because it just makes it so much easier.
I'm sure Oscar Wilde would have come out with something like, the only wise person is someone who knows they're stupid.
That's right.
He was famous for these wonderful juxtapositions, you know. Yeah,
that's exactly it. But the point I was going to raise, because it really does seem as though that ability has gone. People seem to be in this state of arousal where any potential incoming information is dangerous and has to be sort of taken through a filter of, is this dangerous to me? People's level of alarm is much higher. They're sort of their internal fire alarm, as I call it, their sort of whole defense system, their amygdala, it's scanning for more danger. It's more sort of highly primed. One of the examples, I think it's a really great example that helps people understand. I wrote my second thesis on violent video games and aggression. The interesting point that has come out of all of this literature research on violent video games over the years is that the one very, very robust result, regardless of how this is analyzed, is a widespread increase in what we call hostile attribution effect. Are you familiar with that term? Hostile attribution effect. I'll give you the example. If you've got teenagers at school who are walking down the hall, let's go with our 14 and 15 year old boys, because they're always the sort of bubbliest. So one of them's walking down a hall, he's got his bag over his shoulder, and he accidentally knocks into another child, another teenager. What's increased is that decades ago, you had a far higher likelihood of the person who was bumped into to say, oh, no worries, mate, that's all right. Whereas now the hostile attribution effect has increased so much that the person bumped into will see it as a specific direct attack and turn around and want to take reparative action, isn't the right word, but fight back, basically.
Retribution.
And that's where we have seen so many more fights breaking out in schools. So many more fights. I don't know if it happened in New Zealand, but we had this absolute tragedy of what they were calling king hitting, one hit sort of deaths, where this sort of thing was happening. Someone would turn around, a boy would turn around, punch the other one in the face, which of course happens in all of this media all the time and doesn't seem to affect people. But actually, if you take someone out full force in the face and they go back, they have a very high likelihood of dying. And it was happening. So they brought in some law here called, I don't know, something or other about one punch, king hitting. But it's that. So this hostile attribution effect where everyone is in a place of feeling as though they're in more danger. People are far more likely, and especially those that consume violent media, to see that as an attack. And so they will immediately go back on the attack. And I think that example, which is pretty easy to understand within violent video games, is what we've got within the COVID situation, this sort of new world situation with our families, with all these really divided relationships, where people are almost expecting that punch. So they're ready, like a boxer, with their fists up to respond, which is not how we should be.
So I'm gonna bring Renée in just one second, because I know I want to hear what you have to say about this, Renée. But just before I do that, doesn't this mean, Roz, that on the basis of what you've just said, that over the Christmas dinner table, when someone we're talking to from the family member or a good old friend or whatever, when we're with them, we should not believe the apparent calmness of their demeanor, their appearance of social ease. We should understand, we should treat them with the gentleness that we would treat someone who's just walked in and been in or seen a car accident. Like they are on the edge. So one of the messages I'm wondering that we're conveying is there's no point pretending that the people you're talking to have a resilient nervous system. They are on edge. They have been aroused, not in a sexual way, but in a threat way by years of fear. And therefore, you must really treat them with the same gentleness and soothing that you would a beloved family member who's been traumatized. They are a victim of trauma. Have I got this right?
Yes. Yes.
I also,
and people might not like this, but it's how I feel about the whole sort of COVID years, is that we need to treat them absolutely in the way you've described, Jerry, but we also need to be aware that they are operating emotionally, unconsciously, almost from that level of a very defended teenager, adolescent, who has those barriers up that are going to come up very, very quickly and without conscious intention. So we do have to handle them very, very carefully. And that's hard to hold
that
space with.
And I'm coming to you, but I just want to share a little example of that. Yesterday, I was talking to my grown-up son. He's 36 years old, all right? And boy, was he a teenager. I mean, was he a he did teenager like a master, you know, he really did it. And I could just walk in the room and sneeze and that would be it. Why was I this awful dad? You know, so I was the side of the, and you know, it's taken until yesterday for me to turn around and say to him, son, I really love you, but sometimes you're a complete bastard. You're really impossible to be with. And when you're like that, we all know that. And we just keep away from you because you're like a bear with a sore head. But when you're like this, because he was open, I said, I love you. And you're so lovely to be with. And you know, I'll take both. So that was 36, age 36. So what's that? He was doing that at 11 and 12. He started early. So that's like 21 years it's taken me to be able to say to him, I love you. And you behave badly sometimes, you know.
Can I ask, Jerry, I'm curious, sorry, Renee, I know you want to talk, but this is a really important point. Do you model your own bastardry in front of him? Because that's the other really important thing, is to own our own foibles when we fall into that space ourselves and say, oh, my God, I really got triggered then. Whatever language you use, because when you do that in front of others, that frees them up and removes some of the defenses, maybe not immediately in the situation, probably not, but over time where they can do it themselves.
Well, my first response was, what on earth do you mean? You know, how could I possibly have any bastardry in me? No, that's just the first defense. It's automatic. It's I would call it script bound. And I see it because I've done a bit of work on myself, and then I have a little laugh. And then actually one of the things, it brings us right back to humor, is one of the ways I do that is I absolutely capture it with humor, and I often ham it up. You know, I'll often make it more absurd, you know, how unreasonable can I get, you know, and I will get people laughing about it because not only will I see it, but I will make a joke of it. Because actually in my system, in my psyche, one of the best ways to disempower the parts of me that think so seriously of themselves and take themselves so pompously and so seriously is to just put a rubber nose on them, or put a reindeer head on them, or put a Zorro mask on them and just start having a laugh. You know, that completely dissolves the power of those introjects upon me, you know. So that's, yeah.
I suppose from a medical point of view, How I do that is actually to imagine them without any clothes on. And then you have whatever the arrogance or whatever the pompousness is, then I feel a bit like the emperor has no clothes.
Well, René, you gave us a beautiful example of this on our last Psychobabble, because you talked about how you walked in to this A&E session or this extreme emergency session and dealing with a woman that didn't want any male doctors. And you said, well, you know, I'm afraid you're going to have to talk to this, I don't know, 180-year-old white male fart, you know. I can't remember. I've exaggerated, but, you know, and it was a beautiful example of what Roz was saying, which is actually, you know, I'm gonna nail it, name it, and then I'm gonna take all the clothes off it and have a laugh at it, you know. So René, we've been shutting you up for the last 10 minutes. What do you want to say about this subject?
I have essentially nothing to say, so I think it's fascinating to listen to you, because I think this idea of that middle realm, that realm of the heart, actually of where communication, genuine communication, actually is. Because we were talking about pompousness or non-real self, but the real self is really that genuine, vulnerable, humoristic part that can look at him or herself, laugh at him or herself, and yet take him or herself very serious at the same time. And so what we were talking about just before, and I wonder if I can make quite a big strange loop, because it seems as if it's not related. Yesterday, I listened to an interview in Holland, or in Dutch rather, by a doctor who apparently was born, as turned out in the interview, in the same place that I was. And she was talking about this whipped up East-West controversy, which might well lead to a Third World War. And it reminded me so much what she said and what I experienced. When I drove as a young child in the late 40s, early 50s, when my father drove us in as a family on the way from the East-West road from Amsterdam to Germany, which is very close to where I lived, then he would say, you know, I want you to realize you're actually on the road between London and Moscow, and you're in the way between London and Vladivostok, which I just quickly looked. London-Vladivostok is 12,000 kilometers. London-Moscow is about 3,000 kilometers. Now, then going back to the interview where this woman said that she was on the station in Hengelo, where I was born, and I remember exactly having had the same feelings. And she said there she was on the platform and she saw this enormous train, much longer than the train station. And there you had these blue wagons and they had on them CCCP. They were Russian trains. And they were going indeed from Amsterdam to Moscow and to Vladivostok. And that was, and then later you had the Cold War. And I was thinking that going through all these countries with all these people who were all having families, who actually all have the same ideals of peace, living together, being able to manifest themselves. The one comes from London, is going to Moscow, where they're absolute polar opposites, and they're actually in the Cold War with 200 kilometers to the east of where I lived. You had the Pershing rockets from the Americans against the Russian rockets. So you had this train going through all these areas with all these different people, all these different countries that were more or less at war with one another. And that brings me right back to what Ross said this morning, that you had the First World War. These people were in the trenches, they fought each other, millions and millions of slaughter, actually just the most brutal, machinated war of slaughter.
The first industrial slaughter of humans, yep.
And many have followed, unfortunately, after that.
It was the industrial scale of it, wasn't it, that was shocking? That was new.
Yeah. Yep. So you didn't have any blood on your hands anymore by literally killing the person with your own sword, but it was a machine gun. And then it was Christmas time. And what they had done, there was this one day of truce, and Ross said it. And out of the trenches came the German soldiers, and out of the trenches, just 100 meters or 200 meters to the west, came the English soldiers, British soldiers. And they played soccer together, they played football together, and they sang Holy Silent Night, Holy Night, in German and in English. That, for me, means that actually all that we have in the way of animosity and warlike atmosphere is all whipped up, manipulated stuff. Mm-hmm. And I saw that also this, the atmosphere of Christmas, that we can have that. Mm-hmm. Because that is actually what we talk about, this inner part, this genuine part of us, this nurturing vulnerability in the Christmas story of the child within us. And that is where it speaks to the poorest shepherd's hearts, because it speaks to the heart. It enlightens the heads of kings who come on the 6th of January. So it means that for all generations, if we can come into that atmosphere of genuineness, of wonder and goodwill, then there is indeed a peace on earth. We can do that. And then so that was one thing. Another thing was this morning, every Saturday morning, I go to a cafe and have two eggs on toast and a coffee, and I read the newspaper. This is my ritual. And there are actually about five people who do the same. So we become really sort of friends. And I was reading this morning an article in the New Zealand Herald about RFK, Robert Kennedy Jr. And is he a crusader or is he a crackpot? And this whole article was actually so negative, so denigrating, that he had been a drug addict in his teenage years and all of that. And nothing was good about him. And then I saw that it was literally taken from the New York Times. So if we lose that middle realm of actually independent, genuine thinking and feeling and expressing ourselves, then we come in immediately, automatically, as a defense in that dualistic thinking of us and them. And then I can either become quite oppositional, or I can, in the freeze or fight or flight reaction, but I've actually lost my humanity.
Yes.
And in that one particular instance during the First World War, in this incredible inhumanity, there was that one little moment of inner peace, and that light moment. And we are now exactly in the same situation, where instead of wanting to make peace in the world, it is this manipulation of thinking it's inevitable that we get a third world war, or it's inevitable that we have nuclear war and all of that, because we let ourselves be manipulated into this dualistic thinking of us and them. And that is of the past, that has no place anymore in our consciousness.
Couldn't agree more, Annie. Beautiful. I love the way you've brought the everything you've said, but I love the way you've brought this moment in history in World War One. And Roz, I think you had something you wanted to say about that. Am I right? Or
when we were talking about these divisions before, usually in the course of development, let's go back 50 years before media, social media, etc., really changed the entire trajectory of children's development. What we would expect to see is when children are in those early teenage years, when young people are in those early teenage years, so they're sort of beginning to become their own person, we expect them to defend, to fight their camp. It's the norm at that point for them to be very black and white in their thinking. But the next stage, and this is what we seem to be missing at the moment, and I will bring this back to World War One, the next stage is when they've had enough time, which they should on their own, to contemplate, yes, they will break through that and they will get into what Gordon Neufeld talks about, mixed feelings, understanding that it's okay to hold two different points at the same time. It's okay to be in a point of conflict and hold both of them. You don't have to have a right and wrong. But that doesn't come through until the later teenage years. And as we know, certainly the prefrontal cortex doesn't finish developing till mid-20s or even later 20s. At the highest orders, that can be later into those years. And I think what's interesting, yet in a tragic way, when we talk about that you know, sort of World War One, one of the reasons we have our soldiers at such an incredibly young age is because they don't have it yet. And it's very easy to tell a 17 and 18-year-old boy, here's a gun, they're your enemy, go and blow their heads off. I mean, I've got goosebumps, it's disgusting. What I had heard about that situation on that Christmas as well was that apparently when they then ended the ceasefire and went back to fighting the next day, apparently a lot of them couldn't. Mm-hmm. And had to leave. But I think we really are in that situation where so many people are still operating. And I'm not saying it pejoratively, I'm saying it absolutely objectively. You can have an IQ of 180, you can have 1,000 letters after your name and still operate from that place of earlier teenage years where you can't hold those mixed feelings and mixed concepts. And that's pretty much where the majority of the planet is at the moment, I believe. Exactly as you described in that article about Robert F. Kennedy. I was reading a similar one yesterday about Jay Bhattacharya, who to me, I believe is, you know, a man of deep, deep integrity and a very good person. Yet, because the authors don't like his one position on vaccines, herd immunity, etc., everything that's written about him is damning. Right? There's nothing. They can't see the positive. And while we're in that place looking at people as either friend or foe, then we're really in trouble. And this is, again, why it's so important for us to be able to model our own inner fool, right? Laugh at ourselves and let other people see us laughing at ourselves. Openly discuss, particularly with COVID, openly discuss when we got things wrong. Oh, I remember when I used to think that. Gosh, I can't believe it, right? That frees other people who are stuck in that sort of dualistic position, black and white thinking. It makes it a little bit safer for them to soften. And until they soften, they can't unlock their really strong cognitive,
So good what you say, because I remember the title of an American movie called Girl Interrupted. Don't know if you remember that. That describes what later became known as borderline personality disorder, which is actually a terrible term.
Yes.
And it is really more and more is being replaced with complex PTSD, which I think it is.
Yes.
But this interruptedness in the development, because you said exactly that in the early adolescence, it is this lashing out or whatever. And then you grow up further when this prefrontal cortex is starting to develop, then you start to be able to have these various parts within yourself, recognizing them, and trying to come to a degree of peace with them. But if, because of the trauma, that development is actually not able to properly take place, then you have to seek the security into the either or. And that's exactly what we see. Now, the problem is that in all of us, it has nothing to do, by the way, with IQ, as you say. This is far more to do with EQ than IQ. Yes. But the problem is that in our development of consciousness where we're in, where this is supposed to happen, there is the manipulation to bring us into the regressive dualistic state. And that is, of course, where then you ask, well, what is behind this? And why is this so deliberately and so detailed chosen as attacks onto our own genuine human being?
Let me slow this down. I want to just capture what we've been saying. And I want to just make sure that I've got this. At least I want to share my understanding of what we're saying. I really like the fact that you used the word regression, Rinny. And I like the fact that it wasn't that we were interrupted in our development, but this is a place we return to at a core primal kind of security survival basis. So it's not that we're underdeveloped, or anyone who holds a black and white view is lacking some psychological developmental history, because I don't like that idea. I like the idea that we are fully developed humans who have been placed under extraordinary stress and pressure to make us or stimulate us or in some way aggravate us into a place of regressed survival mode. And we go into this black and white place. And what you ask is, you know, why would anyone do that? You know, why would anyone want to create, but back to the kind of the culture, the environment we're living in, which is a psychologically manipulated culture, why would anyone want to do that to human beings, to put them into this regressed, slightly animalistic phase, certainly a long way away from prefrontal cortex analysis, from being able to say, oh yeah, there's this side and there's this side. And, you know, once upon a time, I used to read the newspapers, for example. I used to sit down and read have a cup of coffee and read the newspapers and go, oh, that's interesting. We've got this side here and we've got this side here. And this is all very stimulating. I'm enjoying this. I don't know what my position is fully, but I'm enjoying some really well-informed people writing and interesting stuff. You know, and that was before we got the babbling post. You know, talk about babbling without any psychological, no psychobabblers here. We're talking about the babblers, where you've got a sheet of paper full of disaster, fear, and judgmental one-sidedness, at which point I stopped reading newspapers, you know. And so we're operating in an environment that is attacking our capacity to be in this middle realm, Rennie. I loved it when you bring your body into our conversations. You keep I know I'm the body worker, but you always remind me of our bodies. And you talk about this middle heart space. Right at the beginning, you were talking about the middle heart space, the train that travels through the animal to the thinking, that somehow that train running from London to Vladivostok, you know, is the connecting point between where we might keep being pushed or nudged, is the more accurate word, which is into these animalistic regressive states. But as human beings, we must find the heart. We must travel through the heart. We must travel through the heart to find our rational human thinking, our complex ability to hold multiple realities, to understand that not one point will cover everything, that we have this idea of nuance, if you like, the place where we can contemplate nuance, and that it is through the heart, I'm thinking, we're talking about. And do you know what operated the heart in that World War I scenario that we keep referring to? It was the sound, because it was first the singing. They heard the Germans singing whatever, what is the German for silent night?
Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht.
Beautiful. And the English started singing the English version. And it was through the sound. And I think this is really symbolic. That's why I wanted to come back to it, because sound is emotion. Sound connects us. You know, on my Real People, we do a conversation, which is lovely. We do reflections, which I think is lovely because it's me. And then that's an example of me taking the piss, because I don't want to take myself too seriously, but it gives me a chance to reflect in a very prefrontal cortex way. But then I ask my guests, I say, give me six pieces of music from different periods of your life. And what happens then is, as soon as we start talking about music, it's like then we connect with our emotions. And I can connect emotionally with the listener of the same piece of music. And there's something about the sounds. And I think of this as the sound was the beginning of creation. In the beginning was the Word. God spoke and the world was created. Not through any action, through sound. And I think sound and vibration, however we like to talk of it, is at the center of our connection with the heart. And this image of these young men who've been aggravated into a state of hate by this military, the emergence in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, the very beginnings, the birth pangs of the military-industrial complex that is still trying to create a third world war right now, the emergence of that military-industrial complex and the psychological hatred that would have been generated in those young men. And then there is this moment on Christmas Eve of such stillness, where they hear the sounds of the German soldiers. I'm getting quite emotional, because it's that beautiful sound of a little baby, and the respect we give around a young baby, the hushness around the birth room, the sacred nature of energy around a new birth, and the vulnerability, the utter vulnerability of that baby. And when I hear that, and you think of those young boys, I think boys, 17, 18, don't you?
Absolutely.
And I think of them hearing their mother's song in the middle of this war. And I think that's where we have to go. We have to go to the most vulnerable parts of us and our need for nurturance. We all need it, whatever our bloody opinions are. And across that Christmas dinner table, just see the vulnerable baby in yourself and in the people around you. And think of those soldiers reaching out, because that enabled them to get out of the trenches. It enabled them to play a common language of football. And the really important part was when the officers heard about it, they did everything they could to stop it, because they knew these boys wouldn't fight again.
Because that is so good. And thank you for being emotional, because that is exactly what it is. That is where, in that silence of the heart, that's actually where morality lies. And if we would listen to that, we wouldn't actually even be able to make nuclear weapons, because something would stop us and say, I'm not wanting to be part of this. I'm not going to be part of the manufacturing of this. And not only of that, but similar, if there would have been any morality, then the pharmaceutical industry wouldn't have made any mRNA vaccines or technology. A gain of function of virulence, if you can keep that in your thought, then you have completely lost all morality in your thinking and your feeling.
Yeah.
May I make a suggestion? It would be beautiful to have some music right now. And what would be nicer than listening to Silent Night in German?
Yeah.
I think that's how we're going to bring this psychobabble panel to a close. That's where, that's a beautiful ending for our Christmas special. And what a piece of music for us to launch into. Renee, thank you so much. Roz, bless you and thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.